Welcome to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines what people around the world are doing to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Today's question is, with the dominance of capitalism all around us and the focus on GDP as the only measure of success, can we find a way to interact, exchange, and benefit from our labor without destroying the planet in the process?
And Shareable is a nonprofit media outlet and action network that empowers people to share for a more resilient, equitable, and joyful world. And that joy part was really important for us because we felt like there's so much enjoyment that comes from sharing.
That's Tom Llewellyn, Director of Strategic Partnerships with Shareable, a nonprofit media outlet that highlights the sharing economy, collaborative consumption, cooperatives, and the commons.
Shareable has been around since 2009, and we kind of came together to spread the untold stories or undertold stories of sharing. And initially, the idea was to try and start a kind of global sharing movement. But very soon, we realized there was already a movement underway. It just didn't get a lot of press. And so we kind of wanted to focus in on the media aspect to begin with. And Shareable is a nonprofit media outlet and action network that empowers people to share for a more resilient, equitable, and joyful world. And that joy part was really important for us because we felt like there's so much enjoyment that comes from sharing and collaboration. And so we did want to start with that storytelling part, and we've got this weekly magazine where we produce about, I don't know, 4 to 8 stories per week about sharing. But then that community organizing part, bringing people together in physical space to share resources, to collaborate on events, and to try and network the various projects in their communities was really important to us. So we started what we refer to as the Sharing Cities Network in 2013. And that was there to kind of complement our third program, which was our policy work. And in 2011, we hosted the first conference on sharing cities in San Francisco called ShareSF. And that kind of started to launch a global movement of sharing cities, which now there's, I think, about over 50 cities that have an official sharing cities program worked into the city government. So our work is really focused on that media and storytelling, the community organizing, and we work with groups to start over 50 sharing initiatives, providing seed funding for those and advising for a lot more, and then also the policy work and pushing sharing cities.
All right. We'll talk about sharing cities in a moment, but I want to dial it back a little bit, and let's talk about sharing and the sharing economy. We've heard an awful lot about the sharing economy. Of course, Lyft and Uber and Airbnb sort of grab all the headlines for good or bad reasons. But Shareable is more focused on the, if I can use the word, traditional essence of sharing a cup of sugar with your neighbor, shoveling the driveway, clearing off the leaves, getting together and collaborating on a project or a makerspace or a tool library. So how is Shareable connecting those different groups together?
Yeah, I think a lot of that came from the Sharing Cities Network that I was referring to before. And there are so many people that are engaging in sharing one way or another already. And so kind of our idea was to try and connect people to share those best practices and to support them to build out new projects. One of the things that I like to touch on is so simple, it's the tool library idea. And there's so many people that have lots of tools that they never touch in a year or very, very rarely. And a lot of other people that don't have access to tools. And tool libraries are something that have been around for a very long time. They were informal for quite a while. And there was kind of a push for them in the late 70s, early 80s. The first one formalized in the United States in Cleveland, Ohio in 1978. The longest running one, I think, was started in Berkeley, started in 1979, and is still open today. And there's been through kind of new technology, there's been a resurgence of the tool library idea. And now we've got almost 100 tool libraries in the United States and Canada. In Toronto, there's three. So it's a good mix of that on-the-ground community infrastructure, sharing a physical good that is enabled by technology in a certain way. So that's just like a really great example. And of course, I'm a little biased. I actually am a co-founder of a tool library in Asheville, North Carolina, which I started before I came to Shareable. But there's different ways. It's very easy to do it. In Vancouver, there's a group that started to turn shipping containers into tool libraries. And through the Thingery project, have made it really easy for anybody to start one, to be able to have it be contained in a shipping container. So that's a very relatively low barrier to entry into the sharing economy when it comes to creating community infrastructure. But as you mentioned, like the sharing sugar and food, I'd say that's the other spot. Is really traditionally community has been built around food, and the sharing of food and drink. And a lot of great sharing projects come out of food sharing.
Shareable's based in San Francisco, but you have a worldwide reach. I see articles about Barcelona, about South America, all around the world. Is sharing universal? Is it the same in different parts of the world, or do we in North America have a different take on that?
I think that it is a little different. Right now in the United States and the Western world, we're really focused in on technology. I mean, in Asia and in many major cities, I would say more than any continent, sharing is really focused in on the technological aspect. And I'd say really it's not technologically based at all. It's really there's these longstanding interpersonal relationships that create a culture of reciprocity and mutual aid that has been lost as more and more people have moved to cities and away from their families and communities and places where they've grown up. And so this kind of technological app-based sharing is, I think, more than anything, a desire to get back to having community. We have this kind of global epidemic of loneliness, and it's manifesting itself in a lot of ways. There's connections being made of the opioid crisis that we have growing is connected to that sense of loneliness, and a lot of our consumption is connected there, and just a general level of unhappiness. And it's because people are really disconnected. We have all these apps for sharing information about our lives. They say the more time that someone spends swiping on Facebook or anything else, the more unhappy they get. And so I think that sharing is a great antidote to the social isolation. And a lot of traditional communities, more rural areas, are still sharing. And so it's not as formalized, but it's part of the culture. And that's kind of what I see for a lot of these platforms. I feel like the platforms are more of a means to a beginning rather than a means to an end. That I would hope that at some point in time we get to a point where the apps aren't necessary because the sharing is such a core part of our society, of culture. And in a lot of places it still is. So I'd say it's a little different. But there's a desire to share and a realization that it doesn't make sense for us all to own everything. I think that through the 80s and 90s, there was a big push towards individualism and owning everything that you need. And I think it's starting to snap back a little bit.
Right. Glad you mentioned FreeCycle. There's where I am in Burlington, there's a FreeCycle organization, and I've had a moderator from the FreeCycle organization talk about that, how you can put on, similar to Kijiji, you put on something on the website, say, hey, I've got XYZ, does anybody want it? Someone says, yes, I'm looking for that, and you exchange it. It's a bit further than a tool library by saying, I don't need it anymore, I've used it, and now if someone else can use it, they can take it and hopefully pass it on after they're finished using it. Also, it talks about, Shareable talks about collaborative consumption. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So collaborative consumption is kind of the shared use of goods. And a great example that we've seen for collaborative consumption is car sharing. And, you know, car sharing just about 10 years ago or so was not all that utilized globally. And now cities around the world are incentivizing people to share cars as they realize there's a necessity for that. Because of a lack of space and more people coming to cities and not enough parking spaces, but also from an environmental perspective, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, while some of these kind of car sharing schemes are relatively new, others have been around for quite a while. And a great one is Moto Car Share in Vancouver, which is a cooperative. And they started about 20 years ago with just 15 people and two cars, and now I believe they're past 600 cars and about 20,000 members that all own the platform, and it's a great example of what we refer to as a platform co-op. So yes, they are, you know, collaboratively consuming the use of those cars, but a lot of the kind of digital platforms these days, you know, we look at Airbnb and Uber and others, are owned by a central body that have control and make all the decisions about it. And the users are really at the will of that central body that owns it. And Moto is a great example of a platform co-op. So it's a digital platform. Anybody can call up a car just like they would on any other platform. They can find where it's parked and get in and use it for while they need it and then leave it when they're done. The users are part owners of the system, and so they're able to have voting rights about decisions that are made and can co-govern. And as a result, they've got from the Better Business Bureau, they've got a really high rating, a much higher rating than Zipcar, because the cars are really taken care of because there's that sense of ownership. And everybody realizes that this is a car that they own. In part, and so they want to take really good care of it, and they want to make sure that when they check out another car, that it's taken very good care of as well. And so I think it's a great mix of that shared ownership and a high utilization of a resource.
Right, we're talking about you're sliding into co-ops, worker co-ops, or just co-ops to share different things. What does Shareable do, or what was the focus on co-ops and worker co-ops?
So we've covered co-ops since the beginning and are big fans of them, especially things like the Evergreen Worker Cooperative in Cleveland, Ohio, which is modeled after the Mondragon Cooperative in the Basque region of Spain. The Evergreen Cooperative in Ohio employs over 100 people with an annual revenue of around $6 million. And they have connected into a number of the kind of anchor institutions in Cleveland. And, you know, they run a green industrial laundry, a solar installation, an energy efficiency retrofitting company, a large-scale commercial greenhouse. And they're able to tie in and get contracts, you know, with the local hospitals and other things. And so that's kind of a great model for traditional co-ops and how they can thrive. I think that tying into these anchor institutions and getting these large contracts really makes it work to be able to get that kind of sustained capital. Mm-hmm. But as I was mentioning, we're moving into this digital space. And more companies are going online and not having very much of a physical presence. And more people are participating in the gig economy of sorts. And so it's really affected labor and how we look at labor and labor protections and everything. And to be honest, it's really eroded a lot of the labor organizing of the 20th century, which is kind of disappointing and and also a little scary, you know, as we move into this digital place where there's fewer and fewer jobs because of technology taking over, and there's a worry about workers being further marginalized. And so one of the ways to combat against that marginalization is through ownership. And, you know, TaskRabbit is another kind of company that they get thrown around sometimes with Uber and Airbnb. They're recently were bought by IKEA, but initially the idea was there for odd jobs. You know, anybody could, you know, a TaskRabbit, people that were on the platform, they would do this or that, and it would be graphic design or mowing a lawn or, you know, giving a massage or cleaning someone's house or, you know, anything, little jobs that people would need. It would be an easy way to find an independent contractor to do that. And what happened was is that they, for a while on their platform, they had this race to the bottom where instead of paying market rate for labor or getting paid and a living wage for doing the work, those that were offering services on the platform were forced to bid down to be able to get the jobs. And so it really started to erode the value of labor. And there was a great platform co-op has come up in San Francisco, and they're still growing, but they're off the ground and running, called Localnomics. And the initial idea of Localnomics was to be a TaskRabbit, to be able to offer a platform for people to find short-term employees for odd jobs and also for people to offer their services. But everybody that was offering services on the platform would be a part owner. It would be a cooperative. And so as the platform did well, then or does well because it's in operation, everybody that's offering their services does well as well, too, because they are the ones providing the value to that platform. And an example of that would also be around stock photos. And Stocksy is a platform co-op where all of the photographers that are offering their photos are part owners and get annual dividends and again have governance rights.
Now, a lot of what you've been talking about are captured in articles that are written by writers that maybe on different fields in around the world. They talk about different issues. They bring it to the forefront. So when someone goes to shareable.net, your website, they can look at these articles. They can do some research. You've got an awful lot of background information on the sharing economy, sharing cities, the commons, tool libraries, everything we've been talking about. But I want to focus on something that's relatively new to ShareableNet, and that is the Sharing Cities book that was just published. So talk to us about that.
As part of the Sharing Cities work that we were doing, working with community organizers through the Sharing Cities Network, working with various cities around policy, like the city of Seoul, South Korea, a lot of the communities and groups that we were working with kind of called for a better resource, a competing narrative to that was coming out of Airbnb and Uber and others in the space like that, that have a tremendous amount of political power, as we see the chief kind of political directors of some of these companies having participated at very high levels in government and so they have a lot of influence. And right at the end of 2015, really starting in 2016, we started to work on our new book, Sharing Cities, Activating the Urban Commons, and to be able to kind of meet those calls. But we didn't want to do it by ourselves. We felt like, you know, we had been in the space and we were in a unique place to tell the story and to frame the story, but we wanted to make sure that it really was representative of the global movement. And so we built a fellowship program with 15 fellows from 9 different countries who all collaborate on the book together, and we got contributions from 18 different organizations and did a lot of listening to our community, but also to people outside of our community. And we did about 50 different kind of stakeholder interviews before we even started writing the book as a group, once we brought the fellowship on, the fellows on. So it really is a collaborative book that was crowdsourced, and it's representative of that. There's so many things in the book that we didn't even know about before. It's not just stuff that we kind of recycled from Shareable. I'd say about half the book are instances that I had no idea about. And all told, it's got 137 different case studies and model city policies drawn from over 80 cities in 35 countries. And it looks at the kind of core, a number of core city services that are being addressed by cities everywhere, that need to be addressed by cities everywhere. And so we're looking at housing, mobility, food, work, energy, land, waste, water, technology, finance, and governance. So cities from every single one of those aspects. And we wanted to kind of look at both the way that communities were coming together and community organizers and business owners were kind of democratizing access to resources and building community infrastructure. And then we also wanted to look at it from the policy side, because I think it's really important and often overlooked by community organizers. Definitely been overlooked by myself for many years before coming to Shareable. And so half the book is also these model policies that have already been implemented by various cities around the world that showcase that, you know, this work is possible, you know, what cities can do, because it's been done before. And pretty much everything in the book, I think there's just a couple of exceptions, almost all of the examples have been replicated by more than one city. So it shows that they're not place specific, you know, they could be done almost anywhere. So it kind of paints this picture of the global movement around sharing cities, and also shows that, you know, not only is another world possible, but that much of it is already here. You know, the building blocks for what would be a real sharing city already exist. They're just kind of distributed.
It's a great, great resource. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy. And in true sharing fashion, Shareable.net, you have it available for free download.
That's right. Yeah, we really wanted to make it as accessible as possible. And so, you know, while I will say the physical copy is beautiful, and that's a great reference guide to hold in your hand, for those that, you know, aren't necessarily ready to spend the $25 to hold the full color 275 page book in your hand, the PDF is there for free. And we really want to spread this information and encourage everyone to not only download the digital version themselves, but to share it with their community, with their friends and their family. Share it with a local policymaker. I had a great experience just last week, where I was speaking in Fort Collins, Colorado, and somebody left my presentation and went to their city council meeting and brought up some of the things from my talk. And during the open comment period, and I happened to have a meeting with members of the city the next day, and one of the members of the city pulled me aside and said, "Hey, you know, somebody left your talk and came in and talked about this thing. It was happened to be participatory budgeting. Like, I want to know more." Mm-hmm. And it really does show the kind of that we have a lot more power than we give ourselves credit for. You know, it's not every day that I get to walk into a meeting, you know, the day after having given a talk and have that kind of direct relationship. But I know that's happening. We've heard from a number of our readers who take in these examples, you know, either that they've read on Shareable or from the book, and talk to their local policymakers who are actually really interested, that are looking for ideas to meet, their city's needs. And we feel like this book is a great resource to be able to get ideas for what's possible in your city, and to bring them to, you know, if it's not the city council member, it's your local sustainability director, or it's somebody working on waste management, or meeting, you know, needs around water or housing, and can go in at any level and offer these as examples of solutions.
Excellent point. It's great to be able to go up to someone in authority and say, hey, if they can do it there, why can't we do it here? It sounds like you're hopeful. It sounds like you're encouraged by what you see and hear, and you travel around and talk to different people and spread the word. Tom, I want to get a little bit in the few minutes we have remaining, a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in Charable? You mentioned that you started a tool library in North Carolina. Where did you get your start and interest in environmental issues?
Yeah, you know, I think it was raised into me of sorts. You know, I'm one of 10 kids, so a lot of sharing going on. There's only about four of us raised in the house for the majority of the time that I was alive, but so I've got some much, much older siblings. But I'm from a small community behind Oakland, California, of about 225 people, where we manage our kind of core resources and commons. It's an unincorporated part of the county, and so we pave our own roads. And you know, at 10 years old, I was saving my funky shoes because I knew that the road day was coming up, in a couple of months, and I'd be out there with the rake and moving the asphalt around and kind of getting cultivated an appreciation for, you know, what it takes to manage community, you know, infrastructure, and to do it as a commons. And out here we have our own kind of community governance system of sorts, and we manage our own water systems, and there's been periods of time where we provisioned our own internet service through mesh networks, and so I've gotten to live really as a commoner. And I think that tied in with the at the same time I'm out in this redwood forest that was completely clear-cut in the late 1800s, to the point that they didn't leave a single old growth. And as a child, we would have class inside of these stumps, of this. And so I got this understanding of a deep sense of loss and of what happens when resources aren't managed correctly. And so I think that kind of strong commoning upbringing, and also that strong sense of understanding of bad resource management and what the long-term effects of those combined is what launched me into my kind of community organizing and environmental work. And I ran a project called the Sustainable Living Roadshow, where we traveled across the country for about 5 years, educating about sustainability in fun and engaging ways. And did events all over the place with a large scale show of sorts, with trucks and trailers and domes and stages and a whole Carnival Midway and a big crew, and as we were traveling, we really we were talking about everything that was possible, a lot of the same things that we're talking about on Shareable now, but we wanted to be able to better model what the things we were talking about looked like. And so in 2011, we started a community center in Oakland called a Place for Sustainable Living, which is still going on today. It's actually going to be having its 7th anniversary coming up here in May. And it started with a fab lab and a bike kitchen and co-working space, an events barn, a community garden, and has evolved to have a tiny house village as well. And really wanted to kind of model what the kind of urban village can look like, and bring in a number of the resources that are necessary for that. And so that was kind of my first foray into kind of creating new community infrastructure. And then that led to moving on to Asheville, North Carolina, and starting the tool library there, and continuing in with doing community asset mapping. And that's kind of what brought me to Shareable.
Tom Llewellyn from Shareable, thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters.
It's been great to be on. Yeah, thank you very much for having me.